Consultant Asia podcast. My name is Cassie. I am your host, and I'm very happy to join you in this space where we talk about all kinds of issues from the lenses of human rights and democracy. I am joined by my co-host, Carlo.
Hello, Cassie. It's nice to see you again.
Oh, yes. It's nice to speak to you again. We've had quite a bit of a break in recording these episodes, so I'm really happy to be back with you.
Yeah, definitely. It's especially now, there's a lot of things that's happening in the world today, so it's important for us to go back to our roots, especially on socialism, right? On social democracy and progressive ideologies.
Yes, I agree. And I'm really excited about today's episode because we have another special topics episode. We have a special topic episode about BP Koirala.
Oh, that's nice. It's who is BP Koirala, by the way, for those who aren't familiar with him?
All right. So BP Koirala is actually one of the foremost figures of socialism and democracy and progressivism in Asia. And I am excited to get this program kicked off because this podcast has been, like, this specific episode is the first opportunity I've had to hear about him. And I've had quite a bit of difficulty finding some resources about him. I look on YouTube and there aren't a lot of videos in English. So I'm really excited to bring our speaker, to bring our guest into our conversation.
Okay, let's meet him.
All right. So coming on to our program, I'm very, very excited to introduce to you, Carlo, and also to our audience, we have Dr. Menendra Rijal. He is a former Minister of Information and Communications. We have a former cabinet member on the podcast. I think that's a first. That's really cool. He is a member of the Central Working Committee of the Nepali Congress Party. He's a member of Parliament and the chairperson of Apex College. So, Dr. Rijal, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Doctor.
Sorry, please go on.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. I'm pretty so happy and feel honored that you have asked me to share Nepal's story, talk about BP Koirala, and let the young social democrats in Asia know more about Nepal and about BP Koirala and democratic socialist tradition in Nepal.
Yeah, exactly. We'd really like to know more about BP Koirala, Doctor, because whenever we have, you know, we meet our Nepali comrades, whenever, you know, before the pandemic, when we had meetings with them during conferences, they always say BP Koirala. That's like, it's almost becoming synonymous when you say socialism for Nepali, for progressive ideas, the name BP Koirala always comes up. So, you know, as a non-Nepali, I'd like to know more about him because he's a really fascinating figure.
I guess, I mean, if I have to summarize him in one sentence, and I will just borrow from what he had to say in the past. I mean, he always said, we will not let democracy be stifled in the name of socialism, nor will we accept exploitation of common layperson in the name of democracy. So that's the basic guiding light BP Koirala always holds so close to his chest. And his philosophy as it stands today has evolved into the ideals of Federal Democratic Republic of Nepal. And those ideals are enshrined in the Constitution of Nepal, the Constitution that's written by the representatives of the people. BP, right from the outset, back in 1949, I mean, he asked people to join the revolution. Back then, he said, I mean, Constitution of Nepal would be written by people of Nepal, their representatives. And that, it took long and arduous struggle for us to get there. BP was no more when the Constituent Assembly wrote the Constitution. But still, the Constitution has enshrined the ideals BP fought for his lifetime. Let me just read out a part of preamble of our constitution that probably would give a very good introduction as to how the social democratic tradition has come to be enshrined in the guiding document of our country. In the preamble, the constitution says the objective of our constitution is to establish a prosperous nation by remaining fully committed to socialism based on democratic norms and values. And when we say democratic norms and values, the preamble clearly states that it includes, among other things, does not limit to those only, includes, among others, people's competitive multi-party system of government, citizens' freedom, fundamental rights, human rights, adult franchise, periodic election, full-fledged press freedom, independent, impartial, and competent judiciary, and rule of law. And that probably is a pretty good edifice for what one would call social democracy or democratic socialism in the world.
So, Dr. Rijal, that sounds really good. So, the fact that that's in your constitution, and because it's in your constitution, that BP Koirala helped put together. I have to ask, what was the situation in Nepal before these changes happened? Like, what was the environment in which BP Koirala's politics was formed that ended up appealing to the entire country?
Let me go back almost 75 years in the history of Nepal, right? BP took part in the India's independence movement, Quit India movement, and was a time when BP was in Indian prison and his father was in Nepali prison. BP takes a lot of inspiration from his father, who was a prosperous individual, but I mean, he put his life on the line and challenged the Rana rulers. Rana rulers were, king actually was a titular head only. Rana rulers had taken away all the powers back then. And when BP's father stood against the Rana rulers, that was a pretty challenging thing. And BP was born in India when his father was in exile, because he simply could not live in Nepal. But now let me go back to the story that I was saying. And BP participated in India's independence movement. And both father and son were so committed that father was in Nepali prison, son was in Indian prison. So BP takes inspiration from his father. BP was in the same prison as the first president of India was, Dr. Rajendra Prasad. So he takes inspiration from him. He takes inspiration more so later in his life from Mahatma Gandhi. He met with Mahatma Gandhi several times. India's leader, socialist leader, Jayaprakash Narayan was used to be a very important part in his BP's life. I mean, BP, he was like elder brother to BP Koirala. Likewise, Lohia was also pretty close. So from the Indian freedom movement, he came to Nepal and then thought, I mean, Nepal should also fight for its own democracy. When India was independent, then first they thought, I mean, India has to be independent before Nepal could gain democracy. And then when India's movement was successful and India was independent, then it gave him all the impetus to lead a democratic struggle in Nepal. So he led a people's movement, and the promise, as I mentioned earlier also, that the promise was, come and join the movement. Come and when you join the movement, and when we have a movement strong enough to bring the Rana regime down, then we will hold election for the Constituent Assembly, and that Constituent Assembly will decide on the Constitution of Nepal. Movement was successful, but during the movement, King Trivan had to leave Nepal and go to India because I mean, he was too scared of Rana rulers. And then the movement BP led brought the king back into Nepal, brought the monarchy back in Nepal. And then first government was formed, and the promise was election to the Constituent Assembly would happen. Did not happen. We established democracy, but slowly Rana rulers also were trying to hatch their own a plot against democracy, which was not very successful. But on that gave a good pretext for the king to, King Trivandrum, who was established after the success of the revolution, who had promised the election to the Constituent Assembly. But he changed his mind a bit. I mean, he probably was thinking that he probably can assert a bit of the power. So Nepal had to wait for almost 10 years, 8 or 9 years, 9 years for a general election to happen. Election did not happen to the Constituent Assembly. Election happened, king gave the King Tribhuvan's son, King Mahendra, gave the constitution. And then BP had no choice but to participate in the general election, because then he thought, I mean, had he not, had he decided not to participate, then that probably would have given the new king a pretext to start his own authoritarian regime. BP participated in the election, won 2/3 majority of the in the election, became the first democratically elected prime minister. But 18 months down the road, King took it over, put BP into prison. He put him in prison for 8 years without any charge at all. I mean, but BP continued his struggle for democracy. In 1968, he was freed from the prison. And then at that time, he again started movement to restore democracy in Nepal. I will take a pause there and go back and add a few other bricks in how the democracy movement started in Nepal. As I earlier mentioned, that his father was important, his family was important, but equally important were his colleagues. I mean, one name that comes to mind is Subarna Samser. Subarna Samser was a very rich Rana, but I mean, he was taken out of the Rana lineage. And then at that time, they used to call Class A Ranas, Class B Ranas, and Class C Ranas. And Subarna Samser was Class C Rana, but I mean, he was a very, very wealthy person. I mean, he was a great financier behind BP Koirala. BP became, after the advent of democracy, BP became Minister of Internal Affairs, Home Affairs, and Subarna Samser became Minister Finance. And he was the one first to bring the first Nepali budget. And he was the one who first established the theory that all revenue goes to the coffer of the state, not into the coffers of the ruler. So he gave the budget, and then he was a very important pillar behind BP's success. So I certainly would fondly like to remember his name. And he was so important that when the first general election happened, it was Subarna Samser who was chairman of the Council of Ministers to oversee the election, the election that elected BP Koirala as the Prime Minister of Nepal. And in the new government also, Subarna Samser became Deputy Prime Minister, Minister of Finance. So now I go come back again and then talk about the events that followed after BP was freed from the prison. Then he launched struggle against a panchayat regime or a party-less authoritarian system of the king. He was in self-exile in India for 8 years. But for a few years, he preached for violent struggle to bring the authoritarian monarchy down and start a constitutional monarchy. But after 6 or 7 years of his experience of being in India and leading a violent struggle against panchayat, he changed his mind. He became a Gandhian. He started following the ideals of nonviolence. Then he thought of national unity and national reconciliation with the constitutional monarchy of Nepal. He came back to Nepal and his slogan to come back was national unity and national reconciliation with all the forces, with all the national forces in Nepal. One of the reasons that motivated him to do what he did was towards the fag end of his stay in India, Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi had taken all the powers and had established emergency rule in India, which he didn't like. And then he thought he was also not being treated fairly during his asylum. So he thought probably Nepal should find its own solution. This has to be a homegrown solution. There has to be some reapproachment with the monarchy. And then he started. And then his idea was to establish full-fledged democracy with constitutional monarchy through constitutional and peaceful means. In few years, BP came back in 1996. In he created such a situation that King was obliged to hold national referendum declare national referendum in 1979 and hold national referendum in 1980. But after the King declared national referendum, people loyal to the old establishment or old order started regrouping, and then they thought, I mean, they had vested interest to save monarchy and then prompt monarchy to go back into the authoritarian roots again. So what happened was during national referendum, the national referendum basically was rigged, rigged in favor of a party-less panchayat system. The King had promised that there would be adult franchise, but on the basis of party-lessness. B.P. Koirala didn't like it. Multi-party system had gotten 46% of votes. Party-less system, because with the strong backing of the King and all the rigging that they had done, and with all the resources that are used in favor of a party-less system got 54% of the votes. B.P. Koirala accepted the verdict of referendum. The reason he did was he wanted to establish democracy through evolutionary mechanism. He wanted to reconcile with the King. He knew the outcome of a referendum was stolen, but I mean, he still thought, I mean, there was all the incentives for Democrats to find a space with the King. So he tried to influence the King, find a space for multi-party votes in the new constitution. The King did not oblige him. So BP was still fighting for democracy through peaceful and constitutional means. But BP, unfortunately, BP passed away in 1982. And his party continued the struggle for restoration of democracy. And second most important person in his life or in his party, I mean, his colleague who was his lifetime friend, Ganesh Man Singh, led the struggle for restoration of democracy. And democracy was restored in Nepal in 1990. 1990, this was a time when almost a quarter of this world established democracy. Even Soviet Union crumbled down, and then East Asia also got democracy. So I mean, we also got democracy then. I will pause there for a moment, and then probably when I guess I will get a chance to talk about Mao's violent movement conflict also, which happened starting 1996. But until now, I have paraphrased Nepal's history from establishment of democracy to struggle for democracy, restoration of democracy, and Ganesh Man Singh, I mean, as I mentioned earlier also, BP Koirala's lifetime friend, a very close friend, was the one who led the struggle for restoration of democracy in Nepal. Now let me go back a bit, and now let me talk about how socialist movement started out in Nepal. Yeah. So BP Koirala, first general election happened in 1959, but in 1955, BP adopted the Social Democratic Platform in its party. Democratic socialism was enshrined as one of the ideals of Nepali Congress in 1955. BP Koirala stepped aside, let Suvarna Samsher become the chairman of the party, and then because of Suvarna Samsher brought affluent families together, Suvarna Samsher represented that background. There's some kind of reassurance to many well-to-do people that somebody like Suvarna Samsher is president of the party. So he let Suvarna Samsher lead the party for a little while when he established social democracy, democratic socialism as the ideals of Nepali Congress. And when he got first elected, I mean, the programs he instituted largely had to do with establishing the order, the democratic socialist order in Nepal. He first started out saying abolishing Birtha land system. Birtha land system basically means the kings in the past or Ranas in the past used to grant wholly exempted land to people. They did not have to pay any taxes or anything of that sort. So B.P. Koirala abolished or eradicated that part, that no land is exempted from state tax. Every land owner, whether Birtha or any arrangement that could be, cannot be done without paying adequate taxes to the government. Second thing, I mean, we very, very strongly believe that all forms of exploitation based on land had to be abolished, because Nepal back then was almost entirely dependent on land for its gross domestic product. So land was very important. So I mean, land reform program was his second most important platform. And then he talked about cottage industry, so that Nepal can become little too self-reliant in providing food, shelter, and clothing to its population. So he was thinking of Nepali Congress government in a span of 5 to 10, 15 years, transform Nepali society from largely agrarian to self-reliant villages with some scale of industrialization, with some infrastructure. And then one of the things, I mean, he articulated until late in his life was, back then when he became prime minister, he had a dream, a vision that within 15 years, meaning back in 1960, he thought within 15 years, meaning within by 1975, every Nepali would become a Nepali, would become a middle-class Nepali. Middle-class, a member of middle-class family, just like B.P. Koirala used to be one when he was prime minister of Nepal. So that dream that he has was very important. So now I've added the social democratic platform, how it came into being in Nepali Congress, how it was enshrined in the first budget that B.P. Koirala's government presented, and the government programs that B.P. Koirala presented in the first parliament. And then I guess the story now I've narrated until now is until the restoration of democracy in 1990, which was done under the leadership of Nepali Congress. And I'll pause there for a moment and then just get your reaction, and then probably can either continue along that line or do something else. How do you feel now? How is it going?
It's going fine.
Yeah, it's going fine. It's a whole story.
it's a really long, you know, history also of Nepal's journey with socialism, with democratic socialism. So it's a good thing to hear also as well. Cassie, do you have anything to ask before I ask my question?
Something that I would want to know a little bit more about in specific was that it seems that the king and a lot of the groups that held power in Nepal had a lot of fear of B.P. Koirala, to the point that he was already suffering from cancer and he had to be treated. But they were still so afraid of him, to the point that he had to be exiled out of Nepal. What were they so afraid of? Like, what was he drumming up among the citizens of Nepal that made the king be afraid of him, that made the people who held all the power over the land be afraid of him?
I will not be too long in this one. BP was enormously popular. When King Mahendra gave the constitution and then decided to hold the first general election, he was under the impression that there will be a hung parliament. No political party will have a clear majority. But to his surprise, I should say to his dismay also, B.P. Koirala won more than two-thirds of the parliamentary seats. I mean, he is so popular. Even after he was released from the prison in 1968, even after he came back from self-exile in India, 1976, then we had the third generation of the monarch that BP was dealing with. Not King Trivan, not King Mahendra, but King Mahendra's son, King Birendra, was the king of Nepal. And then at that time also, he could so directly link with the youth of Nepal, so clearly tell and articulate the story and catch their imagination, catch their aspiration, And that is enormously important. And then he has left us behind a party that's still so popular because of BP Koirala's doing, and still, I mean, our party, whenever we go to election, and the first picture that goes out into public is BP Koirala's picture. So still, we are piggybacking on his achievements and his popularity among large masses of Nepal.
Wow. Doctor, it really seems
nobody like him in Nepal. Yeah.
Doctor, BP Koirala really, you know, based on how you tell his story, he really seems like a larger than life figure. But you also mentioned a while ago, no, that a lot of these achievements that BP Koirala as a political leader would not have been possible without his colleagues. You know, you mentioned Subarna Syam Serana, right, a while ago, who served as his deputy prime minister.
Yeah. And as Mansingh, member of his cabinet.
And as member of his cabinet. And so what I'm trying to point out is can you also share, you know, his colleagues in the Nepali Congress, how it shaped Nepal's history? Because from what I understand from your story is, you know, before BP Koirala, before the Revolution for Democracy, Nepal was really a feudal society, no? More like a country in the Middle Ages. But how did BP Koirala and the Nepali Congress, how did it as a socialist movement transform the country? What's the element behind it? How they were able to achieve that within a span of a few decades, actually?
Let me just mention the most salient point. BP Koirala was a student activist in India. And he had just finished his graduate school and then joined the Indian Liberation Movement. And other members, Ganesh Mansingh had already been in prison a little earlier than BP Koirala, but with a different political party. But later, when he met with BP Koirala in India, joined BP Koirala and joined Nepali Congress, I mean, they together formed the party. Subarna Samser Rana has a different party. Two parties came together, and then Nepali Congress, as we know, was created in 1946. And there are a few other people who are very important. I mean, they are also, most of these people were the ones who were being, who had just finished their graduation, were still studying in India. I mean, the Indian freedom movement really inspired and instilled a value of democracy, a value of socialism, the friendship they could cultivate with the socialist leaders in India or the other democratic leaders who they could spend time during prison in India or during the movement, really inspired and instilled a sense of national pride, sense of duty to the nation. I mean, the patriotism, the real inner feeling of patriotism that was instilled in their minds. And the reason I did not take all the names is because, I mean, I have a story to tell until, I mean, story that has unfolded until now. So, I mean, I will now go on to one very important person in this whole story, who was also part of the movement of Nepali Congress, who was founding father of Nepali Congress right from the outset, BP Koirala's days. BP, but he was 10 years younger than BP. BP was 36 when Nepal established democracy. BP was 46 years of age when he became prime minister. And now Ganesh Mansingh also was a year or two junior to BP Koirala, so almost same age cohort. But others, there are others who were a little younger than him. The first name that comes to my mind is Krishna Prasad Vatrai, who also became prime minister of Nepal, and who, after the successful restoration of democracy in 1990, was proposed by Ganesh Mansingh to become prime minister of Nepal. King had originally asked Ganesh Mansingh to lead the nation as a prime minister. Ganesh Mansingh thought, I mean, he felt the health was failing, so he thought the most important person would be then president of Nepali Congress, Krishna Prasad Vatrai, who was speaker of the parliament when BP was prime minister of Nepal. So Krishna Prasad Vatrai led the government. He gave a new constitution, which was a compromise document that enshrined constitutional monarchy and democracy to building blocks of the constitution. that was promulgated in 1991. And Krishna Prasad Bhattacharya, really, truly a Gandhian leader in Nepal. I mean, man who had no family, who was never married, who had no property, no bank accounts. Very simple life that he led, and the profoundest symbol of sacrifice and simplicity one could see in almost anywhere in the world. I mean, he was a real Gandhian in all senses. Krishna Prasad Bhattacharya did hold the first election, and then he was so committed for impartial election that he lost the election. But Nepali Congress, again, after 30 years, won a majority, almost two-thirds majority, and BP's younger brother, Girija Prasad Koirala, became the second democratically elected prime minister of Nepal. So in the history of democratic Nepal, Suvarna Samser did hold the first election to the parliament, right? BP Koirala became first democratically elected prime minister. Krishna Prasad Bhattacharya, another Nepali Congress leader, led Nepal successfully with a new constitution into second general election, and Nepali Congress won almost two-thirds majority, and Girija Prasad Koirala became the prime minister. And the story does not end there. In 1996, Mao started an armed conflict. When they started their armed insurrection, this was guided against the constitutional monarchy, which was against parliamentary democracy. They wanted to establish Maoist communist rule in Nepal. Then what happened was King Birendra was killed in a palace massacre. I mean, many people in the world probably know that part of the story. Yeah. And after the palace massacre, his younger brother, Gyanendra Shah, became the king. And Gyanendra Shah, when he saw that Maoist insurgency was at its peak and provided a good pretext for him to step in, then he removed another Nepali Congress prime minister, Sarwal Deuba, who is current president of the party. After removing him from office, King Yanendra started his own authoritarian regime. Back then, Girija Prasad Koirala, the second democratically elected prime minister of Nepal, who is BP Koirala's younger brother, was still alive, was Nepali Congress's president. He led the struggle to restore democracy again. But then he thought, Mao's insurgency was becoming very important, and finding ground and bringing Mao's into peaceful national mainstream was very important. So he sat down with the Maoist, asked Maoist to renounce violence and join the peaceful movement against the king's authoritarian regime, king's autocracy. And then Maoist joined Girija Prasad Koirala, and under Girija Prasad Koirala's leadership, King Gyanendra had to accept the demands of the popular movement, Nepal, the most popular people's movement, I would say. This was a epoch-making change that Nepal has witnessed. And then King agreed to hold election for the Constituent Assembly, and agreed that Constituent Assembly would write the Constitution of Nepal, and anything Constituent Assembly decides would be decided and would be honored by the king. So what happened was, under Girija Prasad Koirala's leadership, the movements, this was achieved, and Girija Prasad Koirala was successful in asking Maoist to join the government, promulgate an interim constitution, hold the election for Constituent Assembly, and later the Constituent Assembly wrote a new constitution. Though for the first Constituent Assembly was not successful in getting the constitution drafted. And what happened was, there was a brief period when there was no Constituent Assembly, no parliament. And then we had to again compromise with the Maoist and other political parties and form a government that could hold election for the second Constituent Assembly. In the first Constituent Assembly, we did not have majority. Maoist had the majority. They were the largest party, not outright majority. And Maoist thought, they will get their way through. and which is not possible. And then it took 4 years for them to recognize that they cannot have their own way. I mean, they had come to the political mainstream of nonviolence and democracy. So they gradually realized that. And then once we had the second Constituent Assembly, people returned Nepali Congress as the largest party. And then again, another leader of Nepali Congress, Sushil Koirala, became the Prime Minister of Nepal. And under his leadership, we wrote the constitution that parts from the preamble that I read out at the beginning. So the constitution we have now and the preamble, some parts of the preamble that I read at the beginning are from the constitution promulgated under the leadership of Nepali Congress, another Nepali Congress leader, Sushil Koirala. So now I have brought in B.P. Koirala, Shubharan Samser, Ganesh Man Singh, Krishna Prasad Bhattrai, Giriza Prasad Koirala, Sushil Koirala, and current president of the party, former Prime Minister Sarwadu Deva, and into the picture of how Nepal came into being what it is today, how Nepali Congress came into being what it is today, how it led the struggle for establishment of democracy, restoration of democracy, restoration of peace and tranquility in Nepal, writing of the new constitution. I guess this probably sums up pretty well as to where we are today, and probably we can now talk about the challenges facing today, where we are in terms of the history and in terms of the future prospects as a nation today.
So that's actually really amazing. And B.P. Koirala, you mentioned that there has been nobody like him in Nepal or in Nepali politics, that even today when there are parades or when there are marches, like, it's his image that gets flashed. So he lived quite a long time, at least like relative to me, because he passed away in 1980, but his influence remains. Can you tell us a little bit about like what his ideas about social democracy or about democratic socialism were all about?
Thank you. He did not live long. He was 68 when he passed away, but sounds like he was there forever when we go back to Nepal's history. And we can find him in today's Nepal also. I mean, his contributions, his impressions, his influence still all over the place today. So when talking about democratic socialism, let me try to outline some of the important issues that he thought constituted the basic pillars of democratic socialism in Nepal and in many third world countries. I mean, for that, I will borrow from his speech or the remarks he made in the Socialist International Sydney Conference in 1980. Since we are part of Progressive Alliance, we are part of Shock Dem Asia, and there is a history and tradition of Socialist International Movement also. Probably talking about what he had in BP's life time, there was no Progressive Alliance. So, I mean, Nepali Congress was completely part of Socialist International. So BP was a very bona fide member of Socialist International. So let me go back and talk about five important points that he said, five basic pillars that he outlined in his very short remark in Sydney. First, he thought political institutions are very important. Economic development is important, but involving people at every level, right from the grassroots level to the national level, is very important. Because if decision making and implementation is not done with the people's deliberation, people's participation, then authoritarian rule can emerge at any time. In the name of democracy, somebody might say, well, economic development is so important, let's forget about democracy for a little while. So BP, right at the outset, right back then in 1980, also at the time when probably not too many people have realized the importance of democratic institutions, so thought the most important thing was democratic institution and decision making and implementation with the involvement of people, that's right from the grassroots level to upwards. Second, he thought was very important in our context, in Nepali context, which depends enormously on foreign aid, but it used to depend more so on foreign aid back then. He thought very strongly that foreign aid had created a new class in Nepal, the class that did not have its roots in agriculture, the class that did not have its roots in industry. So the class for its advancement thought never of any importance of agriculture or industry, meaning that even if industry did not prosper, even if agriculture did not prosper, they could still prosper by manipulating the foreign aid. So, I mean, he identified that the class that was not rooted in the nation, that was not rooted in the people's plight of development, plight for development, manipulated aid, and then were engaged in corrupt political behavior or engaged in illegal trade. That probably kind of what one would now days call rentier capitalism, right? I mean, he saw roots of rentier capitalism forming back then in Nepal also, probably in many other countries which are very dependent on foreign aid, were dependent on foreign money and did not have a very strong economic foundation within country, neither agricultural nor industrial foundation within the country. And third platform he talked about was intermediate technology. I mean, he thought infrastructure was important. Nepal was very deficient in infrastructure, but he thought self-sufficient villages should be the centers of the development. For that, intermediate technology is important. I mean, he borrowed from Schumacher's idea of small is beautiful. He thought clean development was very important. Environment was very important. He was not impressed by resource-intensive American model of development. He thought, I mean, if everybody followed American model, I mean, there will simply not enough resources in the world. World will be depleted with natural resources. And then he probably could foresee today's problem that we are facing problem of climate change, global warming, environmental depletion, ocean warming. And on this one, I guess another inspiration he draws from was from Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi so strongly pleaded for self-reliant villages. Mahatma Gandhi so strongly pleaded for local panchayats, local bodies making decisions for themselves. So for BP, I mean, it was very important to create, use intermediate technology so that affluent class without national roots would not get away with what they were trying to get away with. So the fourth platform he thought was very important was social democrat anywhere in the world should support liberal democracy, movement for liberal democracy throughout the world. I mean, he thought, I mean, a movement for liberal democracy anywhere in the world was very important. I guess here also, I mean, you can see precursor of what has become very important, the movement towards right extremism and movement towards left extremism. He could foresee that probably would come to the world in future. The fifth platform he thought was very important was the platform of socialism, platform of non-alignment. And he thought, I mean, third world, democratic socialism was the way forward. So he thought we had to guard from drifting into fascist militarism or dictatorial communism or obscurantist reactionary religious fundamentalism. I mean, this is like someone talking to us about today's problem. Talking about environmental problem, talking about the climate problems of climate change, talking about the fascist militarism, talking about the problems of dictatorial communism, talking about the rightist reactionaries in the world. I mean, and then he, back in 1980, envisioned that these could evolve into a problem of global order in the days to come. And now I move a bit into what he outlined as his vision for development of Nepal. as I pointed out, I mean, democratic institutions were very important. He wanted to be, as I outlined earlier also, resource prudent. He didn't want to use too much resources. For him, I mean, self-reliant villages are important. For him, intermediate technology is very important. And for that, he thought, I mean, the building blocks should be education without educating masses. Back then, I mean, Nepal's literacy rate was not even 40%. Back then, he thought the most important thing was every Nepali should be entitled to basic and universal high school education. That was important for him. And then he thought health was very important. And to him, preventive health facilities were more important than curative health. He thought 85% of the disease that people from tropical and subtropical countries suffer from can go away if we can provide clean drinking water to people. So, I mean, he thought after education and health, clean drinking water was very important. So he thought, I mean, if we could use our resources so that we provide universal and basic education to everybody, and then provide healthcare, preventive healthcare, and provide safe drinking water, then we probably would create a ground for development of a nation. To add to that, he thought of self-sufficient, self-reliant agriculture with using intermediate technology. There he thought seeds were important, providing fertilizers was important, small irrigation facilities would be important, not large dams, but small irrigation facilities, and then providing market was important. To him, when one talked about food, shelter, and clothing, for him, shelter, meaning houses should be built with the local materials as far as possible, because he thought, I mean, Nepal did not have a good manufacturing base, so importing a lot of goods to build shelter would not be possible. So he thought using indigenous technology and small houses would be very important for Nepal. And then for clothing also, he thought cottage industry should provide, not the Western mills or mass-produced clothes, but I mean, cottage industry providing clothing for people who will be important. But I mean, on these three ideas, I mean, on food, shelter, and clothing, UK, he borrowed largely from Gandhi's self-reliant villages, and on technology and development, he borrowed largely from Schumacher's idea of small is beautiful. So this is what he thought was very important for Nepal to move away from what it used to be back then as a largely agrarian society, full of exploitation of people who were marginalized in many ways. So this was one of the most important platforms BP had. I should rephrase this. This was how BP articulated his platform for social democracy, his platform for development, his platform for a global economic and development order, and then foresaw some of the problems that world might face in the future. And I mean, left enormous. Made enormous contribution for Nepal and left something that the world might and still can learn from what he had to say back then.
Sorry, but like I find that amazing, like especially the point that you mentioned about how it feels like BP could see into the future. And that's a comment that a lot of young people are saying today, that there are like all these pieces of literature that look like that they could tell the future. But that's not at all what was happening. It was a recognition of the system. And that system is still in place today, which is why it feels like all of these things that were happening back in the day are so prophetic. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah. I'm going to pass it up to Carlo, who has to bring up an important point to be discussed.
Yeah. So Dr. Rijal, you mentioned the legacy of BP Corrales' work, not just in the past, but also in the contemporary period, that you can feel the basically the reverberations of BP Corrales' legacy right now, right? So that's also partly, if I can summarize, that's also partly of his struggles, of his friends, but also his colleagues in the Nepali Congress. So I'd like to also point out that there's also another movement that was created, in the two decades ago, right, that sprung up in reaction to many of the social problems, but had a very different strategy as to Nadepali Congress's non-violence democratic strategy. And I'm referring to the Maoist movement. Can you describe what was the context that they sprung out of, and how did the Maoists view Nepalese society, and what were their solutions, and how it fundamentally differed from Nepali Congress's view, solution, and the vision for the country?
I guess, I mean, in, if I say in very short, I mean, they wanted to establish Maoist authoritarian proletarian regime. But I mean, that probably will not be doing a lot of justice to them, because they have made some contribution in bringing the society where we stand, where we are today. One of the things, I mean, as left movement anywhere in the world, the movement, that part of the left movement that does not think of democracy as too important, the part that thinks economic development is very important, Maoist movement brought that into Nepal. So, and the context in which they started their movement was after the democracy was restored in 1990, there are two or three important forces that were playing a part in Nepali society. Number one, that elections had happened at the national level, had happened at the local level, and then people's aspiration after the world became more global village, people were exposed to all the development that has happened throughout the world, the aspirations that came with the new technology. People started thinking that, I mean, they deserve better. They deserve better. They were becoming a little too impatient. They were a little too impatient with the slow and tiring process of democracy, which because it takes longer to deliver. Though, I mean, what it delivers is very sustainable, but many young people many times feel quite frustrated, and that probably is the reason why you see many uprisings and springs or yellow vest, red vest, Jasmine movement or Arab Spring that we see all over the world. And that probably was the sentiment was there. The democracy is there, but hey, quickly, it has to deliver. And democracy had not delivered economic development as quickly as young people wanted. And Mao's thought, and that was a very good breeding ground to start their insurgency. And they did. I mean, they won over a lot of younger crowd from other political parties. And in the, did the indoctrination, and then they created their own, what they call was combat force, and that led the violent struggle for 10 years. Another breeding ground that was there was because if you look at the discrimination that you can see is multifaceted discrimination in Nepali society. One based on caste and ethnicity. People are of certain caste and ethnicity are less developed or have access to less resources than people of other caste and ethnicity. For example, I am upper class Hindu Brahmin, come from an educated family, come from a feudal family, I mean, well-to-do family. I had everything going on on my side when I started out. Right, and I'm one of the luckiest ones to be in Nepal and in Nepali politics. But I mean, the plight of many Nepalese were not as good. So people who feel were marginalized because of their caste, because of their ethnicity, or because of their residence, because of some people who were living in far out places. I mean, Nepal is a rugged, Nepal has rugged topography, you know. I mean, mountains, hills, and do not have a lot of infrastructure. People living in far, far isolated villages with no transportation, no communication, no health care facilities. I mean, they felt, I mean, they were from remote places and then were marginalized because of their geography. There are many others who felt that they were marginalized because then their mother tongue was not Nepali national language. For example, I speak Nepali, Devanagari Nepali, But there are people in plain region of the country. They feel that because their mother tongue is not Nepali, they have been marginalized compared to people whose mother tongue is Nepali. So, I mean, you can see, I mean, there are a variety of ways, a variety of pretexts in which people are marginalized. And then two important groups I should mention now, and that they probably are marginalized the most, the Dalits, like the very strong stratified caste system Nepal has. And then for some worst reason that happened in the history of Hindu culture, that some people are thought to be untouchables in the society. And that's still, well, that was still there. And so untouchability should go away. And people who were considered untouchables by a high caste people, they thought, I mean, for them, the only emancipation was through violent struggle that Maoists were leading. And so many of them were indoctrinated into Maoist ideology also. And some women who thought the plight of women had been very bad because of the gender discrimination was so paramount in Nepal that some girls, they really took it in their hands and joined Maoist movement. So I mean, what that brought into is, I mean, violent movement was there, violent insurgency was there, provided pretext for King Gyanendra to take over. But Nepali Congress leader, then President Girija Prasad Koirala, who I mentioned earlier, also B.P. Koirala's younger brother, who was second elected prime minister, democratically elected prime minister of Nepal. Then he took a real serious, hard look into what was happening in the country. And then he reached out to the Maoists, asked Maoists to join the mainstream, asked Maoists that one of the important building blocks of Nepali society would be creating an inclusive society. So Maoists thought, I mean, if the commitment's full for constituent assembly elected by people, for inclusivity at all levels, and to make Nepal a federal democratic republic, then Maoists thought it might be a good idea to join hands with Girija Prasad Koirala and participate in the peaceful struggle he had waged against the king's direct rule, and which was successful. And Maoists thought, I mean, my dear, it would be a good idea if the issues of inclusivity would be addressed, issue of establishing federal democratic republic, federalism and republican order were very important. So, I mean, they thought, I mean, it would be a good idea to join hands, and they join hands, and then the order, political order that we have created is a peaceful, democratic, federal republic, with greater provisions and strong provisions for inclusivity, because at every layers of the governance, not in the executive yet, but in the legislature, there's a provision for 1/3 women. We have proportional representation that guarantee the representation of Dalit, the untouchable community, and proportional representation guaranteed based upon the identity of people who were marginalized back then. So I mean, the new constitution has provided a strong ground for all Nepalese to come together and evolve as a peaceful society that has all it takes to take a political take it as a political foundation and transform itself into a prosperous democratic nation. Though, I mean, we have currently certain problems. I don't want to get into those problems because they're still unfolding. We're still trying to do away with that. But most importantly, the Constitution provides a strong, solid foundation on which basis we can strive for establishing a prosperous democratic Nepal, and where prosperity is for people all of all identity. There is a strong ground for that. And we are very happy that the constitution's there. And we will do our best to keep the constitution going, keep the Nepali society moving, put our acts together. So any challenges that we see from any extreme, left extreme or right extreme, that society shows the sign of coming, we will be very, very alert and then make sure that the democratic order just keeps on moving forward.
That's really amazing. Like, we were just about to ask you, like, with the whole struggle with the Maoists, like, how was this resolved? And you already gave us the answer that through policies and through making it inclusive, they were effectively brought in. And so that brings me now to the last thing that we would like to ask you about, like, BP Koirala and all of the things that he has done for politics in Asia and in Nepal. Even though he lived quite a while ago, I would say, like, just from the things that you've discussed, that he's still quite relevant today. And so we would want to ask you now, how are his ideas, how do they fit into the world that we live in today, where we've experienced democratic retreat, we're trying to push against it, we are trying to establish a better world for all people based that is actually very similar to the pillars of his democratic socialism that you discussed earlier. In what ways does he still continue, or can he influence how we move forward?
Okay, thank you. Let me just bring out one more dimension of BP's life, and then I will then try to relate the current development debates in the world with the legacy BP has left behind, and how current political debates in the world relate to what we have in Nepal and what we aspire to become as a Nepali nation. First, let me talk about the spiritual aspect of BP Koirala. BP was not a person who, in a traditional sense of the term, can be called a religious person. BP was always aware that, people's faith in religion can be exploited by authoritarian rulers to their advantage. So he was very, very, very clear on that. I mean, to him, religion was not an answer. For him, spirituality was an answer. For him, it was a quest of seeking truth. For him, I guess, in my interpretation would be, religion provides answers for every problem. For him, seeking truth was more important. You find truth for yourself. You become your own guiding light. Here, he was probably influenced by Buddha, who thought everybody has to become his or her own guiding light. So BP always wanted everybody to become his or her own guiding light, guiding post, and find answers for their own problems. One important thing that comes to my mind is when, in his last speech to the mass meeting, he said, after I'm long gone, you probably will not find answers to many of the problems that you'll be facing at your time and age, future generations to come probably will face their own problems and probably will have to find their own answers. And then in terms of message to the people gathered there and probably to many generations in Nepali to living today and that will be living in the future. But he said, if you are confused, if you do not know what to do, confused, then just put your hand on top of your heart and ask your heart what's the right thing to do. And then second thing he said was, take a fistful of soil of your nation and ask that soil what is the right thing for you to do. And then I guess what BP was saying was, BP was saying, ask your conscience. What I have said probably would not be an answer that you're seeking. BP knew, limits of the time he was living, limits of the knowledge individual had. So BP didn't say that, I have all the answers for you. BP didn't say that my party has all the answers for you. BP didn't say my colleagues will be there. BP didn't say leaders of your time of my party will be able to answer. BP didn't say that, read my books, you'll find answers to your problems. He didn't say that. BP said, ask your conscience. Only your conscience can provide answers to the problem that you'll be facing tomorrow. That's really fundamental to BP's thinking. To BP, every individual had boundless possibilities. So he always thought, realizing those boundless possibilities is what the aspiration of prosperity should be in the human life. So I guess that's very important platform BP had in mind. Now let me try to relate BP to the current development debate that we're facing. When I say that, the first name that comes to my mind is Joseph Stiglitz. Joseph Stiglitz, who talks about disparity in the outcome of globalization that people have been able to enjoy. The disparity or income inequality that's widening in today's world. Joseph Stiglitz talks about 1% of the affluent who have amassed a lot of future after 1980 Reagan-Thatcher revolution, supply-side economics, here BP talked about inequality. BP talked about the importance of middle class. And when Joseph Stiglitz talks about, in a very sarcastic fashion, he talks about the best decision and the most important decision you can make in your life is to decide to where to choose parents. And that's the kind of saying, you cannot choose your parents, but depending upon who you're born to, your future or your future plight is pretty much decided, because 1% has amassed so much wealth and income today. So I guess BP also had that in mind. So BP, when he was fighting against Rana's, when he was telling his story or narrating his story to his followers, he was saying that it's not fettered. It should not be fettered. You should be able to toil and then be able to achieve the aspirations, the dream, realize the dreams that you have for your life. So, here I can see how BP relates to the current thinking Joseph Stiglitz has in current society, and bringing the bottom 10, 15, 20% into the development mainstream in the world. Likewise, I can relate BP Koirala to Thomas Piketty. His new book has come, Capital and Ideology, where he talks about participatory socialism and social federalism. So BP, when emphasized the participation of the people at the grassroots level, that was very important. Thomas Piketty talks about, and another platform Thomas Piketty so fondly talks about is not just income taxes enough, because people have amassed wealth and inheritance is the most important gift these rich people give to their children, that income tax supplemented with progressive wealth tax and inheritance tax would be very important. And then there also I can see BP Koirala when he talked about land reform, when he talked about how the wealth was amassed by limited few, were manipulating foreign aid, were manipulating illegal trade, who were feathering their nest at the expense of the large number of people who depended on agriculture or who were depending on developing agricultural industrial base in Nepal. So I guess here I see Thomas Piketty in BP Koirala. Likewise, when I read Francis Fukuyama, when he talks about, I'm not talking about the last man, end of civilization, last man, but I'm talking about political order and political decay, where he talks about three important building blocks for democracy. He talks about democratic elections, our democratic process is important, but that's not enough. Rule of law is important. Democratic accountability is important. So BP Koirala, all through his life, fought for rule of law, fought for democratic accountability. Even in the most difficult circumstances, he participated in the election. Even when he thought the constitution was not enough, he thought, by participating in the referendum, he can create an environment of democratic accountability, which will take Nepal towards a realization of full-fledged democracy. Even when he was fighting as king's authoritarian regime, there are eight criminal offense charges against him. I mean, he went to the court, King's Court, and then argued his case. And there he said, I have trust in the court. I mean, he was showing his trust in the King's Court and saying that I have to be given justice. So he had great faith in the tradition of the judicial system, rule of law, how even in the authoritarian regime, court will assert the justice and provide a ground or provide a way forward to establish a way forward for democracy to take roots. Francis Fukuyama in BP Koirala. Now, and then another name that comes to my mind is AC Maklu and Robinson. Here I'm not talking about why nations failed. I'm more talking about the narrow corridor of democracy, where they talk about the dimension of state's execution capability and the society. If state's too weak, chaos will be there. I mean, like chaos in Nigeria back then, or Yemen for that matter today, when AC Maklu and Robinson talk about if society is very weak, then the system can evolve into a very dictatorial regime. I mean, there are many examples in the world. So, for AC Maklu and Robinson, very strong society and very strong state are the ones, and that interaction of strong society with strong state execution capability can create a narrow corridor. And as long as you can stay within that corridor, democracy will thrive and then prosperity would be guaranteed. So, the challenge that building a vibrant society and building a state that is capable of execution, when AC Maklu and Robinson emphasized that, I see BP Koirala there. So, I've try to narrate how I can find BP Koirala in many of the personalities that are still writing, that are still leading nations, different nations in the world through the process of democratic development, development for all, prosperity for all, and emancipation of humankind of all caste, creed, color, gender, and identity.
My God, wow. Dr. Rajal, thank you so much. This was so comprehensive and I learned a lot. And I am very excited and happy to have learned about this figure who has been in Asia all of this time. Like, these thinkers, like, because part of the reason why we're having the series is to introduce young social democrats or young democratic socialists in Asia to figures from the region, so that everyone gets to hear about Western thinkers all the time, but not so much about the figures from our own region. So it's really great to know that these ideas, they spring up anywhere. They can spring up from anywhere. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insight.
I hope this has been useful. I hope people who will listen to this, the young social democrats who be participating in Shock Demacia's programs will get to know more about Nepal and probably will find some lessons for their country also in the endeavor that they will have for their countries and the aspiration they have for their people.
Oh, absolutely. So if there's anything that you would like to say in conclusion, like if you would like to address our audience, then we would be happy to give you the floor just to conclude for everyone.
I'll be very quick. I knew BP Koirala firsthand. I was a student activist there. I was a student activist. I was vice president of Nepal Students Union. That's the students' sister organization of Nepali Congress. So when spent time with BP Koirala, I got to listen, got opportunity to listen to him almost on a daily basis for almost three years. I mean, he was my inspiration. I mean, based upon his life, based upon his struggle, based on his ideology, I came into join politics. I mean, I come from a very affluent background, but I mean, that was not important for me. What was important was the ideals BP thought was very important for Nepal's future. And that's how I got motivated. And what I saw when I was, got firsthand chance to meet with BP Koirala was, youth were very important for him. He always considered himself as a youth, and he always had a very, very strong connection with the youth. He could always inspire hundreds of thousands of youth. So, I mean, younger the social democrats that you join the political movement, or the ones, even if you don't join political movement, the ones who will use your lifetime effort to better the plight of many poor and not well-to-do people throughout the world. I guess, I mean, we can do a lot when we're young. As we grow older, I mean, there comes a time when we get wiser, but our energy in our body starts giving up. So I guess, I mean, there's a time, there's a limit to the time or age that's very important. So I mean, when you're younger, you can do a lot. And please, please do the best that you can do for your society, do the best you can do for your community, do the best that you can do for nation, and do the best you can do for the global village that we all live together.
All right, Dr. Rajal, thank you so much for your
time.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you for your expertise.
Thank you, Carlos.
This has been our program, our special program about BP Koirala and talking about politics in Nepal. We hope that you guys have enjoyed this. So for everybody listening, this has been the Soften Asia podcast. My name is Cassie.
And I'm Carlo.
And we're very happy to have you with us. So thank you so much for listening to our program, and we hope to have you with us again.